Are communal physical spaces out of date? After all, it's now possible to order just about anything sent to your home and enjoy entertainment wherever you want. The places we used to run into each other, malls, movie theaters, houses of worship, all might soon become relics. And new technologies like virtual reality and AI might accelerate this trend. But we should fight back, according to author and architect Kevin Irvin Kelly. In his book, Irreplaceable, How to Create Extraordinary Places That Bring People Together, Kevin offers ideas for creating spaces that people want to be in, offering an appealing real-life alternative to the digital world. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
Hello, Book Bites listeners. My name is Kevin Kelly. I'm an architect who studies where people convene in the public realm and how those environments affect their behavior, perception, and decision-making. Today, I want to share five key insights from my new book, Irreplaceable, How to Create Extraordinary Places That Bring People Together. The first insight is one of the most timeless, yet increasingly lacking qualities in our world today. Principle 1. We need more bonfire moments that bring people together. I grew up in South Florida, not the palm tree beachside you're thinking about, but way out in the boonies towards the Everglades swamp side. To get to my neck of the woods, you'd have to ride down a long, bumpy dirt road that'd rattle the fillings out of your teeth as you tried to survive the alligators, water moccasins, and mosquitoes everywhere. There wasn't a lot to do in our little hamlet, so we spend our nights, days, summers, and life savings building these elaborate swamp buggies that look like something out of a low-budget Mad Max movie. These vehicles could traverse any terrain, but they took a lot of effort to put together. Where on earth were we trying to get to? The mudflats, of course. The mudflats were the place to see and be seen in my community. However, to get to this Middle Earth destination, you'd have to travel 2 miles out in the middle of a muddy, coffee-colored swamp to eventually reach a mound of sand that rose out of the water like a redneck Riviera resort. But it was all worth it because the highlight of our day started when the sun went down and the bonfire pyramids went up. As part of our weekend ritual, an hour before sunset, a self-organizing group of family, friends, and strangers would work together under the guidance of a self-appointed bonfire master, collecting anything that burned. We then took these sticks, twigs, and empty beer can cases and created an enormous pyramid-shaped bonfire before siphoning off some gas and striking a match. We all did our part in an unusually cooperative manner, but it was the bonfire master, or what we'd call today a chief brand officer, or a chief experience officer in today's LinkedIn world, who led the tribe and created our vibe. Not only did they have to ensure the fire didn't grow too big or shrink down too small, but they also had to help synchronize a group of strangers to feel connected to something larger than themselves. This harmonious quality of the group experience is what Swiss psychiatrist Carl Jung called participation mystique. Principle 2. Society is much healthier when people meet at the intersection of commerce and community. For thousands of years, people have been leaving their homes and places of work to go to the market, whether that market was the ancient agora, the bazaar, or the local farmer's market, grocery store, or mall. But since the advent of the internet, smartphones, social media, and delivery apps, we no longer need to leave our homes to go shopping, buy food, get dinner, go to the movies, or even find a date. We can do all these things from the push of a button in the palm of our hands. And since the pandemic and the rise of Zoom, we no longer need to go to work, go downtown, have water bottle conversations with our teammates, or get dressed up anymore. We can stay at home in our PJs all day and night. But is this progress and convenience all good for us? Or is it possible that something meaningful, important, and connected to our hardwiring happens when we left our caves and couches and met others in the public realm? Although we went to the market to trade money for products, we also went there to trade stories, ideas, values, and cultures. We went there to see and be seen, to find friends, meet new people, and perhaps find our soulmate. But going to the market required embracing certain social norms and rules of etiquette. It required presenting a public self and thinking about our social identity. As humans and members of a community, we learned how to interact and be civil and polite to one another by watching others in public. But this civil presentation of public life is not required online, as we can say, act, and behave in any way we want with little repercussions or peer pressure. The more outlandish our behaviors and the more polarizing our statements, the higher the number of clicks, likes, followers, and friends we get. This daily online training course for how to master social media is affecting the development of our brains, behaviors, and social norms more than we realize. This is particularly true for kids that are still learning how to socially navigate their world. In this book, I'll argue for how critical it is for people to find some time and place in their lives to meet at the intersection of commerce and community. Principle 3. If places want to survive and thrive in our increasingly digitally dominant era, they'll have to provide a bigger payoff for the amount of work they require. Most of us would agree that we're living in a time of great change and disruption, where digital solutions are virtually replacing everything we used to do physically in the real world. According to NASDAQ, consumers will make 95% of their purchases online by 2040. While this prediction is great for the net worth of investors, it's not so good for the health of our communities and local businesses that have historically lined our neighborhoods and served as public gathering points for friends, families, and strangers to meet. As the scale and reach of online entities gets bigger with the steady increase of our dollars, their cost of doing business goes down. But as local businesses lose bits and pieces of our local dollars, their cost of doing business goes up, making it harder to keep their doors open. Amazon alone offers 353 million products online and takes a whopping $17 million out of the market every hour. Local shops, restaurants, and cinemas are realizing they can't compete against the massive scale, reach, and efficiency of digital replacements. As much as they try to keep up, a steady stream of them are throwing in the towel and calling it quits if they haven't already. This book, Irreplaceable, is a crash course in how places can survive and thrive in the digital economy, but it requires understanding one critical aspect of humans, the work-payoff ratio. When evaluating a place, my team and I consider two broad categories. One, moments and situations that feel like work, effort, and exertion. And two, moments and situations that feel like joy, delight, and restoration. We call this dynamic the work-payoff ratio, or WPR for short. When people consider visiting a mall, a furniture store, an art museum, a theme park, or any other place, they subconsciously ask themselves, if I go through the effort to visit this place, what's in it for me? I can see how the place wins by getting me on their premises, but how do I win by going there? Far too many place-based businesses and institutions I study are unsympathetic about the effort required for consumers to acquire their products or offering. But to succeed in today's replacement economy, places must gain clarity on this subconscious work payoff dynamic to ensure their moments of pleasure far outweigh their pain points. The places you see succeeding today generally do an excellent job of making the payoff much greater than the work. Principle 4. Placemakers and place operators need a much better understanding of how the human senses work and interpret our physical world. Despite how technologically advanced our world is, the human body hasn't evolved that much in thousands of years. Our elders often tell us don't judge a book by its cover, which is well intended, but this saying doesn't entirely reflect the primitive parts of our brain that have had to make snap judgments throughout history to survive and thrive in our habitats. We're hardwired to judge things by their covers because in previous eras of lions, wolves, and marauding tribes, that's how our ancestors stayed alive. As evolved as we might seem today, this split-second context scanning and decision-making process never left us. It's still a core part of our environmental awareness and innate survival system. While we're not conscious of it, we prefer the world around us to be stable and predictable because it gives us a sense of control over our environment. But deep down, we know stability isn't always possible. So no matter where we are, we're constantly on the lookout for contextual clues and the slightest changes in our environment. And the tools we use to engage our environments consist of our senses and emotions. While my book Irreplaceable covers a lot on emotions and six key sensory concepts, I'll highlight three of them here. One, the voluntary eye versus the involuntary eye. While all the senses work together to help us interpret our environment, our vision plays a major role in piloting us through the world and steering our decisions in two conceptual modes, the voluntary eye and the involuntary eye. Knowing the difference between these two modes can be incredibly helpful in understanding people's engagement with their environment. The second principle is visual harmony versus visual noise. The human eye prefers visual harmony over visual noise. Part of the reason for this preference is that our body's instinct, if not compulsion, is to try to make sense of an image, a scene, or our surroundings. But when we can't figure a scene or situation out because of a high level of visual noise, our mind gets frustrated and our body's energy wears down. Why does this matter? Well, if you're a school, a museum, or a retail store, grabbing the attention of your audience and holding their engagement is key. The third principle, information overload versus sensory deprivation. Humans have always preferred the beautiful over the unattractive and the stimulating over the monotonous. On a basic level, our definitions of beauty and unattractiveness haven't changed that much throughout history or cultures. Universally, we still prefer qualities like symmetry, composition, rhythm, scale, repetition, proportion, contrast, and surprise. Why do humans seek beautiful things? The short answer is that historically, the things we found attractive to our senses had survival value, whereas we avoided things that could harm us or threaten our existence or our lineage. Unfortunately, many venues such as grocery store aisles, Department of Motor Vehicles, or the post office don't qualify as places humans want to be, much less consider attractive, inviting, or stimulating. If anything, people are turned off by these places and dread going to them, which is problematic for places in today's digital alternative world. But places don't need to be prettified or intellectualized to survive. Instead, they need to be intuitively experiential and tap into our senses in a way that attracts our attention and makes us want to be there. On any given day, we experience a wide range of environments that produce different types of sensations, feelings, emotions, and perceptions within us. One of the major factors in determining how we feel in a space is the quality and quantity of sensory stimuli we encounter, which either act to arouse us or annoy us. Finding that right balance is key to attracting the human eye and ultimately human beings to want to be in a place. Principle 5, we need to learn how to build our own bonfire moments. Over the last 3 decades, I've worked in a wide variety of industries that are at times beyond my expertise or that of my colleagues. But my team and I don't really have to be an expert in our clients' industries as much as we have to be an expert in the process of decoding human behavior and understanding the parameters of an industry or how our clients compete within it. There is a 5-step process we use to normally come up with breakthrough ideas that help us raise the bar for an industry or change the rules of a game. Step 1 is the extraction phase, which is where we're trying to draw out the knowledge and wisdom and insights our clients have within them, conscious or not, about their business, industry, customers, or competitors. We have a series of interview techniques and on-site observations and competitor reconnaissance that we do that you'll find very useful out of the book. Step 2 is distillation. The distill phase entails taking all the field notes and raw data and observational insights we uncovered in our extraction phase and then starting to put them into categories or what we call buckets. These buckets might include things such as design or operations, management or consumer behavior, or organizational issues. We initially put all these different ideas in these buckets without talking to each other. We try not to actually have too much course correction or terminology correction so that we don't bias each other's first impressions. What we're really after is those pure, raw instincts and impressions you get when you see something. Our step 3 is our articulation phase, which is where we start to take what everything we distilled and start putting it into an order from a hierarchy of the one idea that had the most consistent kind of consensus to the ones that had the least consensus. We then start trying to string those ideas together into a coherent strategy and game plan that will build organizational consensus for our clients and that will inspire them to take action with a sense of urgency and conviction. Our goal is to get as simple, as profound as we can be, but achieving this profound simplicity requires combing through ideas and detangling the knots. Sometimes this is messy in the beginning, but the more times we chisel it down, the more times we present it, the closer we get to turning it into generally a one sentence or a three word kind of strategy. Step four is the crystallization phase, and this is our most creative, magical, kind of non-linear part of our work. It's where we take everything, our insights, our findings, our problems, our strategies, and we start kind of turning them from verbal written ideas into physical, tangible, and experiential concepts that actually have form and shape and communicate a whole lot. Our ultimate goal is to turn these complex ideas and strategies into two-second icons or symbols or scenes or scenarios that executives can grasp quickly with enthusiasm and excitement. We know we've hit it with the executives when they tell us that's what they've been trying to say all along. Step five, maximization. The maximization phase helps our clients ensure they capture the full value and impact of a place once it's built and in operation. This step entails adding a series of ongoing brand maintenance tools to monitor their place's health, vitality, and livelihood, which keeps the brand on track and increases market leadership potential. We've developed several tactics which I cover in the book, but I'll go over three of them quickly here. The first one is using speed as a strategy. Many of our clients work in the retail industry or the food industry, grocery industry, and they'll develop a brand new prototype that is groundbreaking. But unfortunately, they will sometimes pose too long for the pictures and take many years before they build the second and third or fourth iterations. This gives their competitors too much time to decode and study and figure out what they're doing. No market lasts for long. No innovation is kind of pure forever. You eventually have to really keep moving forward. And so the thing we try to do is constantly use speed as a strategy. Our best projects happen when we're actually building the second and third iterations while we're still drawing the first one. Now, that requires a lot of confidence and risk, but the best retailers or the best clients know how to do that. The second point is bringing in fresh horses. When a job is finished, it can only take years to complete, and everyone's tired, from the clients, from the designers and engineers, to the contractors, to the vendors. And that tiredness can leave a lot of undeveloped opportunities and innovations on the table. So we try to bring in a whole fresh team to maximize the potential innovations we have. The third one point is to establish a brand stewardship committee. That is, put together a group of a rotating members that can constantly monitor that health, vitality, and livelihood of the brand. Thanks for listening to this overview of my new book, Irreplaceable: How to Create Extraordinary Places That Bring People Together.
Thank you, Kevin. That was five big ideas from Irreplaceable: How to Create Extraordinary Places That Bring People Together by Kevin Irvin Kelly. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.